I am proud to recommend my dear friend Emily Levin, who is the co-founder of the revolutionary company Access. With Access, Emily is able to combine her deep care of those in need with the modern technology that allows their basic needs of housing to be taken care of. I'm inspired by the work Emily is doing and can't wait to see how many lives will be changed by it.
Welcome to The Uplifters, where we share stories of courage, transformation, and the brave leaps that change everything. I'm your host, Aranza Savas, and today I am thrilled to introduce you to Emily Levin, who was nominated for the show by Susanna Ludwig, who was in one of our earlier episodes. Emily is someone who has transformed herself from a trauma therapist working one-on-one with clients to a tech founder tackling one of our most pressing social issues, the affordable housing crisis. Emily's journey began on the front lines, helping chronically mentally ill New Yorkers transition from the streets into stable housing, which led her to become a psychoanalyst and trauma therapist, running her own practice for 15 years. But she always knew that individual healing wasn't enough. The system itself needed to change. And so a year ago, she made a leap that might have terrified her former self. She co-founded a company called Access with her husband, creating the first AI platform that streamlines affordable housing processes. It's a company that's already raising capital, signing customers, and generating actual revenue, all while getting families into safe, affordable homes faster. So today, Emily's going to share her story of releasing old narratives about who she thought she could be, the daily rituals that help her build courage capital, and how a photo of her daughters keeps her brave even when the metrics dip. This is a conversation about transformation, motherhood, and the compound interest of courage. Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So take me back to that kitchen table moment last summer when your husband shared his vision for Access. What was it about that conversation that made you say, against all odds, I'm in?
My husband has been building government technology products for many years and has built many different products for many different city agencies. During COVID, he started working for a New York City agency building the affordable housing lottery system. And so because we were both working from home, I was privy to a lot of his experience with building that product. And we talked a lot about his frustrations and how much he was learning about the affordable housing industry and how broken it is and how broken and siloed the various systems are. He also, on the side, started building Access, which is the AI-powered platform that we are now in the market with, because there was a lot of limitations around what he could build for the city. And so part of his way of dealing with the frustration was, hey, I'm just going to build something on the side. And so when he decided he wanted to go to market, we were sitting down talking about it, and it was just him at the time. He didn't have any other people that he had been building it with. We had technologists helping him, but no one really with really the people skills or the experience in the market actually that I had had as a social worker. And he kind of looked at me like, so, and I kind of panicked and I just said, you know what? Let's just give this a try. Let's see if I can do this with you. And honestly, if you had told me, a month before that moment, if I would ever start a company with my husband, I would have said, no way. But there was something really compelling about what he was building and my having kind of lived on the ground with people in that experience that made me feel like, I don't even know if it was fully a choice. It was like, this is something I have to do. And so from that moment on, I've just been going full force.
Wow. I love to this point that it's really tapping into your innate expertise, because as women, we tend to underestimate our credibility and our readiness to do new things. And what I hear you doing is saying, actually, irrefutably, there is something I know that this guy doesn't know that he needs. And so I'm going to show up with my expertise and use that as a stepping stone to gain more confidence and more credibility in other areas.
Yep. Yes.
You've talked about this in the past as not just a single moment, but I love the phrase, the slow enrollment of possibility. What does that phrase mean for you?
As a therapist working for, 20 years listening to people, I kind of started to feel like a spectator into all of these amazing, brave experiences that people were flying off into. I guess I kind of was slowly signing myself up to eventually kind of join in there with them and not be a spectator. Now, obviously, there's something very active about listening to people and their life experience. It's not like I was just on the sidelines, but I wanted to build something like a lot of them were. I started to get a lot of women in my practice that were mid to senior career, who were working in banking and working in startups, going to business school. And there was some envy. And I always like to think of envy as a really helpful emotion in that it can kind of give us direction around what we might want. And so I think I slowly was kind of signing up and rolling in new experience for myself. So it was a slow process, but I didn't know where it was going to take me. I just knew I needed something. I wanted a seat at the table.
Yeah. I talk about this show doing exactly that for me and for our audience. And so the goal here is really that if you listen to enough of these stories, you will have so much evidence that you can do big, scary, brave things that it becomes impossible to say no to your own calling. And I hear that echoed in your own experience, that you had this front row seat to other people facing their challenges, their fears, their uncertainties, and finding their way through it, that said to you, Emily, if they can do it, you can too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're not just, and this is one of the things that I love about your story is, yes, your experience working with unhoused people, with people who had limited economic access, is super relevant to the experience of the product you're developing. But that's not all you're doing. You're running the business.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the crazy part. I mean, that's the part that I think is every day I'm sort of like, wait, what? But I love it. I mean, I really love it. And a lot of what I'm doing in running the business at this stage is being out there, meeting people, telling them our story. I mean, with a startup, so much, at least in my experience, is the story that you tell. If you're telling a compelling story about a serious pain point and a solution that you have, it's pretty much the most important part of running a company in the early stages. And so I've spent so much time on our story, and that could mean pricing. That could mean, how are we going to get from $200,000 revenue to $200 million, whatever number it is. See, I'm not a great numbers person, but how
same.
Are we going to...
They're like, big. I'll say like, that number's big.
Right, right.
Or that one's smaller.
Right.
It's all very relative.
It's all
and unspecific.
Like, how are we going to get to big numbers?
To be able to say that, actually, this thing that we already do really well is incredibly valuable. And like the success is entirely dependent on that. I think it's a really validating and reassuring idea for those of us who are bravely wading into something new. The things we're not good at necessarily aren't even the most important things.
Totally. And if we tap into the things we know we're good at, that's all we need, really. I mean, I don't know. The story isn't all written yet for us, right? We're a beginning company, but I like to think that tapping into my strengths, my husband tapping into his strengths and kind of going with that is what's going to be useful for us. And it's definitely fascinating moving from a industry that was really female centered. It's like moving from that kind of world into like a very white male world was a little jarring and actually quite shocking to hear that. I think the statistic is like 1.4% of female run startups get funded. Like, that's just insane.
Bonkers.
Like, how?
And I think only something like 16% of founders are even women.
I've had so many meetings with investors. You can really tell there's just a bias that the way men think is what's going to build the next unicorn. I think we as women have to change that.
Men certainly aren't going to change that.
No. No, if they're given the money, why would they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is on us. I think that's important to acknowledge too. This idea that I hear in your telling of this, that you are leading from your strengths, not just as an individual, but as a woman. And so you're saying, this is what makes me different. And this is what makes me better prepared to lead this particular mission. So what are some of the qualities that you're noticing have helped you enter these conversations in this very white male dominated world with confidence? And I'm not even worried about the credibility piece, because I think as women, we put too much emphasis on that, but about your own feelings of confidence and readiness to have the conversation.
Oh boy. A lot of it is practice over time, just continuing to do it. The practice of play is a big piece that comes to mind for me. I sort of conjure up memories of playing when I was a little kid. When kids are playing, everything they're doing is made up, right? Mm. I remember playing that I was a real estate agent as a kid for hours in my room. I would like draw pictures of houses and I would like pretend like I was showing people the house. And I was super into it. I was an architect. I was a therapist. I had so many different careers as a kid. And I didn't know what I was doing. It was like all made up, but I loved it. And it was this magical world. Some point in adolescence, that kind of stopped because we enter into a different kind of pure world. And honestly, sometimes I will sort of bring that time back where I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to play that I'm a startup founder. I'm just going to have fun and like pretend. And eventually, maybe it won't be pretend anymore. Like, it isn't actually pretend. So that's been something that I actually have found really useful and exciting. So I think that's a big one. Community. I've worked really hard to find other founders. Just participated in the Robin Hood Foundation has an accelerator for impact founders. And it was a 5-month program where we all work together. They give us investment and we work as a community on learning a lot of different kind of foundational skills that you need in order to run up a startup. It's a really, really diverse group of people that they get it. And interrupting that loneliness that you can feel as a founder really brings confidence in a way, because you realize everybody's feeling it. Even that person that just got the $10 million investment and looks like they're building this huge.
And you're like, they have it all figured out.
They don't. We had some amazing women come in and talk to us. Amazing, like the founder of Girls Who Code, and so many women founders who just shared their stories and their fears and their anxieties. And these are people who have founded huge companies that have been really successful. And you sort of learn you're actually not really alone in some of these fears. So I guess community, play, sometimes just screaming into your pillow. I don't know. You got to pull on everything you possibly can at any given moment to kind of just keep going.
One of the things you talked about was future casting. And I think that's related to this make-believe play that you talked about, but you described it as closing your laptop and imagining you're already that seasoned CEO. And I love this idea of sort of envisioning your future self. And it's no different than what I do when I envision myself crossing the finish line of a marathon.
Yep. Yep.
I start to cultivate belief that then inspires action. Anything we do that takes a lot of energy and investment physically, mentally, financially, I think from a distance looks really freaking hard. And then, like you and I have learned through our own endeavors, it's okay, take a step. Take a deep breath, figure out the next step. And it really is just a series of steps. But you also mentioned community in here. And you shared with me earlier that when you feel uncertain or you're going into something that is unfamiliar, you call your 82-year-old dad who spent his career in business for a pep talk.
The interesting thing about my dad is that my dad has always been very risk averse and had a legal career for 45, 50 years, like same practice, the same kind of law. Yet when he's talking to me, especially as an 82-year-old who's retired and, you know, he's raised his kids, he has his retirement, like he's on the other side of a lot of scary things I think we go through and maybe into a different stage of his life. There's a certain calm when he listens to the risks I'm taking and a certain excitement that I think he feels living kind of vicariously. So just that kind of implicit communication, like he'll call me every day and be like, so how was the demo? And I went to the library and they were giving a talk on affordable housing and I gave them your deck and you need to send me more decks. And like, he's so supportive and in it with me in a way that is kind of, you can't really get it from anywhere else other than a supportive family member. And I feel like I try to do that with my kids too. In fact, my daughter will be interning for us this summer. She's 13, not sure what she's going to be doing, but she's going to be our intern. And because I keep saying to myself, like, God, this is taking up so much of my time. How can I multitask, right? Because I'm a woman. So it's like, we're always thinking about how we can multitask. And I'm like, I just have to pull my girls into this because that's going to be part of parenting them, right? If I don't have time to go to their soccer game, but like I can have them sit on calls with me or sit in the background and listen, like I think they're going to take in something in ways that maybe they miss out on me being there all the time. I don't know. So I'm trying to actually replicate what my father is doing for me as a mom. And that feels really amazing, I have to say. I have a 13-year-old and a 3-year-old. The 3-year-old's a little less aware, but 13-year-old, I had a pitch for a demo day that I had to do. And I was pitching for her constantly. And now she like walks around the house reciting my pitch. She's like, I know your pitch, mom. Do you want to hear it? And she'll just say it like with all the numbers of our company. I'm getting shivers thinking about it. But I just think there's something about the gift to give your child, especially your daughter, that is really, I hope she'll get something from that because she knows that I'm really a therapist. And now she's like whiplash.
Wow. What an incredible story and experience for her and for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super fun. I'm going to make her business cards. And actually one of her friends is going to intern as well. And I don't know, we'll find things. Like she knows how to use the computer in ways that I don't. She can build decks for me. She can go on TikTok and figure out ways to advertise our company. We'll find things. She'll figure it out.
Yeah. What a beautiful thing to be able to say to both of you too. We don't have to know all the answers. Yeah. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
How does relationship with your daughter and motherhood in general influence your own willingness to keep learning and pushing through obstacles in this process?
I mean, I think it goes both ways, right? Like a part of me is like, okay, my husband and I are taking this big risk. We're building this company. To what expense does that for our children who like, could we be saving more money or, but the way that I counter that is sort of by saying they're watching us as a couple live out our dreams. Mm-hmm. They're watching us live our passion and not just our passion for affordable housing and changing it, but our passion to build something that doesn't yet fully exist. So that keeps me going when I'm like, oh, I could see more patients and make more money and save that money. I'm like, yes, I could do that. But also what they're hopefully learning implicitly is something invaluable that doesn't come in money.
So much richer. I think about that all the time, that I'm not earning as much now as I did in my corporate career. I'm not getting annual merit increases.
Right.
And I'm getting incredible growth in so many other ways.
Yeah.
And so I just started telling myself that like this year's bonus is snack time.
Right.
This year's bonus is, and just like naming these things in the same terms for myself to more consciously equate the value of them. Because I think we do grow up with, at least many of us, so many strong messages about money is worth and value. And there's just so much more to finding our own path. But for me, it really does help to just like give them the same names I used to give them.
Yep. Like, I love that.
Oh, look where I got a raise this year.
Right. Right. Like you're not putting it into the 529, but I think nowadays we talked a lot about in the accelerator program that I was in, we talked a lot about like we're at a real inflection point as a culture and a society with AI, right? Like it's happening. I mean, being in the startup tech world, especially, it's unbelievable how fast AI is moving in.
You guys are tackling an affordable housing crisis through technology. Yep. For people who might not understand the scope of this problem, bring your daughter on, please, to give us the pitch.
Okay. Yeah, totally. So when I was working as a social worker, helping families navigate the affordable housing process, I was working with a mom who was a single mom of three. She had been living in a shelter for over 9 months. And throughout those 9 months, she had been applying to housing. She had a good job. She had good credit. Good. But because of the broken system, she had to take paper applications to all of the different housing facilities to apply. And that required missing work. It required, in fact, some of the units that she would go to look at, she had to go in person. She wasn't allowed to like do a virtual walkthrough or all the things that exist in market rate units that you can do does not exist for affordable housing. And so eventually, I mean, we were trying and trying, and she had to maintain her job. She had to maintain like the three children. Eventually, she just gave up. There's 30 million Americans in the U.S. that qualify for affordable housing. Only 1 in 5 actually receive it. In New York City, a huge percentage of people that get housing vouchers don't actually end up using them because of many different aspects of the system. There's overregulation. I mean, Ezra Klein has been talking a lot about this idea of sort of deregulating housing so that we can just get housing built and get people moved in. Mm-hmm. So because of these broken systems, property managers who manage these properties, it takes 80 hours to lease up one unit, 80 hours.
Unreal.
If they make a mistake in compliance, they can lose up to $7 million per building in tax credit. And vacancies cost property managers $1.5 billion a year. Vacancy. So property managers are hemorrhaging money, these that are managing, you know, affordable units, and people aren't getting housed. So there's a real problem. And most of the property management systems that exist in the market are not built for affordable housing. They don't deal with the layers of complexity with compliance. I mean, it's very, very complex system. So we have built a suite of products that uses AI to read applications. So that 80-hour lease up, which a lot of that has to do with application packets being 150 pages long because people have to submit all of their paychecks. Now with the gig economy, you know, people are working for Uber, they're working for DoorDash, they have all different forms of income. There's many, many different things that go into an application. And our system cuts down that process from 80 hours into minutes. So it cuts the lease up time for property managers, it saves them money, and it gets people housed faster. We also have a waitlist management product. Now property managers are using pen and paper for a waitlist. The average wait time
to get into affordable housing is like 9 years or something, because the wait list is on pen and paper. So someone's up for a unit, they go through the wait list. Half of those people have already been housed. Half of those people are no longer eligible. Some of them aren't even alive. Some of them have moved out of the country.
And I'm sure they just reach out and they're like, hey, you're up. And then there's some waiting period for that person to answer until finally they're kicked out of the queue. And then we go through it again.
Yeah. I mean, it's absurd. They'll send a letter in the mail to the address.
Because people who are looking for a house have super stable residences in general, right?
Totally. Yeah,
makes sense.
So they're sending it to someone's grandmother. It's all just to sort of check off the box. It's not the operator's fault. There just isn't any other better solution. The statistics say that like 95% of people living in poverty have cell phones. So people will say to us, well, these people don't have technology. Like, how are you going to use technology? That's not actually the facts. People have cell phones. There's all kinds of subsidies to get a cell phone. So we send emails or texts to people through our waitlist system every month saying, are you still interested in this unit? Have you moved? Has your income changed? Please let us know if you want us to remove you from the waitlist. Seems intuitive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just stay in touch with people. And the idea is that it will cut down the wait time significantly and fill units faster and keep operators so that they're not losing all their money on vacancies and house people. It's like a win-win for everybody.
I love it.
Yeah.
So I know your next brave step in this is to close your seed round and to scale nationally and then capture your lessons for other founders. What do you most want that book to say to someone who's sitting where you were a year ago?
To start that company that you want to start. Just do it. And that if your company is also about social impact, you don't have to sacrifice revenue, that you can build something that changes our society, changes systems for the better, and also make money. And investors have to know that, because investors say, these systems are so overregulated. How are you going to make money on this? Why would we invest in this? Well, it's a huge pain point. And there's a lot of revenue to be made from these pain points. And you don't have to sacrifice one for the other. And so I want to see more female founders in the impact space who are also raising capital and paying themselves. And I think all of those things can happen.
What would you say then to the person who describes themselves as words and feelings, not numbers and capital?
Yeah, that's me. There's people who can teach you things. If you are passionate about something, the numbers come. They do. They come together, right? You can hire somebody to do numbers. You cannot hire somebody to have your passion and your belief in something. And so I think just start, learn, grow, see what happens, and just live on the edge.
To know that that's what we're doing and it's by choice, and living on the edge is like, instead of it being a place to tumble to your death, it could be a place to jump into a beautiful crystal ocean, right?
I hope.
The chances are you're going to swim.
Yeah, you'll figure it out.
As uplifters, we love to lift up other uplifters. How can we as a community come together to support you and this incredible mission?
That's such a sweet offering. Tell our story to everybody. Go to our website. Tell investors to check us out. Our website is accessaxcces.com.
And who would you like to nominate for the uplifters?
So I would like to nominate my friend Holly Diamond, who is a fellow founder who is incredible. I won't tell her story because I want her to tell her story, but she is an immigrant who has done amazing, amazing things and has so many incredible stories. Every time she talks, I cry. You will be blown away.
I can't wait to meet her.
Yeah.
I'm blown away by you, your journey, your courage, I think is so relevant to so many of us. I And when I think about making big deposits in my Courage Capital account, it always comes from talking to other people
totally.
Who are doing that too. It's like, you've just compounded my interest, Emily. And I wish you so much continued success.
Thank you.
I can't wait to watch this all unfold and all that you'll learn in the journey.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifters podcast. If you're getting a boost from these episodes, please share them with the Uplifters in your life and then join us in conversation over at theuplifterspodcast.com. Head over to Spotify, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast and like, follow, and rate our show. It'll really help us connect with more Uplifters. And it'll ensure you never miss one of these beautiful stories. Mwah! Big love.
Painted water sunshine with rosemary and thyme. Dwell in the perplexing, though you find it vexing. Toss a star and hover, be your own best lover. Relish in a new prime, plant a tree in springtime. Dance with idle hindsight, bring the sun to twilight. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up. Lift you up, whoa.
Mommy, stop crying. You're disturbing the peace.